Hey, gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It is the bank holiday, and it's not just the bank holiday of free speech, it's the saved by the bank holiday of free speech. Because had Mark Collett joined the show yesterday, if it hadn't been a bank holiday, and we'd recorded it, everything would have been wasted because the power was down at RBN yesterday. But that didn't happen. And fortunately, there was a bank holiday, and we're going to be having a nice, fresh show today. So go to republicbroadcasting.org. Keep the lights on. It wasn't actually, it was a some sort of neighborhood problem. Everybody in the little complex yesterday lost their power. But go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send badly needed fundage to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas 78664. Phone it into 1-800-724-2719. Extension 3, operators are standing by, and the power is on. And Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello, Patrick. It's good to be here. Yeah, sorry I couldn't make it yesterday. Those bank holidays, they're always a Monday or a Friday, so I always end up missing either your show or David's show. They're never on in the middle of the week, so I'm always safe with a midweek show. So my own show never suffers from the bank holiday madness. But it was also obviously Easter Sunday as well. So did you have a holiday yesterday as well, with it being Easter Sunday on Sunday?
I never have a holiday. I work basically every day when I have to work, and when I have to play, I play, and if I have to do both at the same time, then I work. When I was a kid, we would get the entire week of Easter off, and we called it Easter vacation. It was called Easter vacation. It started getting called spring vacation sometime in the 70s, but in the 60s, it was Easter vacation up until the mid 70s. And I loved Easter, and it was Christmas was the biggest holiday, but Easter was without a doubt the second biggest holiday. And Easter's become kind of a nothing now. People don't know what it is. People don't know when it is. And it's a shame. And I'm not a religious person, but I actually went to mass on I rode a bicycle down to a nice, nice big church and went in, sat in the back and looked at the ceiling and looked at all the architecture. And it was pretty mellow. But but yesterday the show got canceled because of this electric issue in Round Rock, and it's, you know, so there I didn't even record a show for myself. I had sent in a show that I had done live with David Duke, and I just edited it down to the RBN format, but it didn't even get played. So it worked out for the best. How was your Easter and bank holiday?
Well, I wasn't in the best of health, but I've bounced back. Easter's still quite a big thing here, but they are trying to quietly can it. So even though it's a big thing, they are trying to sort of phase it out. So we have this, I don't know whether you have this in America, but we have this thing called Easter eggs, where people give chocolate eggs to one another. And you have like the idea of the Easter bunny who delivers the chocolate eggs, and you know, children go on Easter egg hunts, and all of these things are quite big here. So basically, as holidays go, and this actually sickens me, by the way, not Easter doesn't sicken me, but this sort of habit sickens me, that in the UK, Halloween takes place obviously on October the 31st. That's always Halloween, so we know that. But literally, as they are pulling down the Halloween decorations, November the 1st is when all the Christmas stuff now goes up in the UK. So the Christmas stuff is on the shelf from November the 1st. You know, the minute they can get those Halloween decorations down and take in the Halloween gifts and, you know, all the chocolates and the scary masks and the dress up and makeup and, you know, fancy dress gear, as soon as that's off the shelves, they have the Christmas stuff up. So it literally goes Halloween, Christmas. But this year, I remember, because what I tend to do, the supermarkets here in the UK are not open on Christmas Day, but they are often open on Boxing Day, the day after. Now, that means if you go down to the supermarket, they've usually got a load of, there's not many people in there, obviously, for obvious reasons, but they have a load of things reduced. And that's why I go down. So you'll often find sort of big slabs of meat, steaks, you know, cheese boards, etc., that were meant to be, you know, like Christmas Day food, basically, that are up for sale with vast reductions. So I like to go in there and get the reductions. And I remember on Boxing Day of last year, going to the supermarket and popping in and seeing sort of, ooh, what have they got on the shelves? And it sickened me. Basically, Boxing Day, they were removing all of the Christmas stuff, marking it all down, obviously, to sell it off. But at the same time, they were wheeling out the Easter eggs. I was just thinking, this is it couldn't get any tighter. You know, there's not a break. There's always got to be in Britain some kind of themed confectionery on the shelves, to the point where there just isn't a break anymore. So all these holidays that as a child they used to be quite distinct. So, you know, Easter and Christmas were very distinct holidays that were far apart. And as a child, I would remember, you know, once you got past that Easter, once you got past the Christmas holiday and you were back, it seemed like a long way until Easter. You know, you were getting your Easter eggs. That was a long way off. But now, basically, that's not the case anymore. It's literally as soon as they can get those Christmas decorations down, it is time to get the Easter decorations up and the Easter eggs out on the things and the Easter bunny, you know, the big Easter bunny cardboard cutouts are in the stores. And it's such a conveyor belt of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And it sort of turned all of these, you know, beloved holidays in the UK into, instead of being sort of separate events, they all kind of like merge into one. So instead of it being three separate events, it's almost like a relay race of events. So, you know, from October right up until Easter Sunday, you have a complete, and Easter Sunday can fall, you know, in April, or it can fall like it has done at the end of March. But that means you've got October, November, December, January, February, March, and sometimes April. You have basically 6 months of the year where all these decorations and, you know, holiday stuff's upon the shelves. And it just seems to be wearing. And in between, you also get smaller holidays. So you get, you know, Mother's Day in this country fall. Mother's Day and Valentine's Day fall before Easter Sunday.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
Yeah, you get like the smaller ones punctuating it. So you get this sort of 6 month like marathon of, you know, how much holiday can you take, basically? How many different things can you buy cards for and all this? And it is wearing. And I also think it kind of takes the sort of spirit of these events away somewhat and makes them less special.
Yeah. And we have, you know, more or less the same thing here. If you go into, you know, Walmart or Piggly Wiggly or whatever you're going to go into, they're going to have that Halloween, and that's going to feed into Thanksgiving, which is a pretty big deal here in late November. So you'll have the turkeys and the autumn colors, and then it feeds right into Christmas. And I was trying to think, okay, I remember being surprised walking into a store at how much St. Patrick's Day galia there was. There was an awful lot of St. Patrick's Day. And of course, St. Patrick's Day and Halloween and Easter were only 2 weeks apart this year, which is pretty unusual. And I was trying to think, well, what goes in between? I mean, not commercially, but culturally, they shove in January and February, they shove Martin Luther King and Black History Month down our throats. But that really hasn't been monetized yet. I think it would be kind of funny. And I wouldn't be surprised if they start pushing like some sort of black chocolate on us, like black chocolate, maybe little statues of Martin Luther King. Who knows? But that hasn't happened yet. And I was trying to think, well, what are they're doing something in between.
Where does Kwanzaa fall? Yeah.
Well, Kwanzaa is the 5 days in between Christmas and New Year's, which actually I'm in favor of Kwanzaa because I think it's funny. And also because it's good for procrastinators. So you can take advantage of the after Christmas sales and give presents to the little kids as Kwanzaa presents, because I'm always busy before Christmas. So I'm actually pro Kwanzaa.
I think it's pure clownery, but it is funny.
It is clownery, and clownery is funny sometimes. So like if they're gonna do Kwanzaa, then I'm gonna take advantage of it. So, but yeah, you got the Mother's Day, you got the St. Valentine's Day. Everything is overly commercial and lost his meaning. And honestly, I hate to say it, but you know, this is largely what the Jews do to our culture. I'm sorry. It's what the Chinese do to our culture.
Yeah, it's the Chi-coms. I mean, yeah. You got to be right about these things, Patrick. Those pesky Chi-coms destroying everything in the wake, and taking it all away from us.
I joke about it, but and this is kind of segueing to what we were going to talk about today. That blaming things on. Okay, I saw a meme on Andrew Anglin's site. He does his Monday sites. Oh, here's another holiday. Yesterday, April Fool's Day, right? So for his April Fool's, he said he's canceling his Monday memes forever out of lack of interest. And of course, everybody loves his Monday memes. And so it was an April Fool's joke. But you go down and he had this one meme. There's a game show, a television game show in the United States called Wheel of Fortune, where there is, you have to guess a phrase or a title of a book or something like that. And the only people, it's popular, but I think most of the people traditionally watched it because there was a once very attractive woman who would manually turn over the letters as you guess letters. Give me an R, give me an L. And if there's that letter is in the phrase, she would walk by and turn it around. Well, because the show's been around so long, but now everything's automated, and but they still kept her on. So she walks past the screen and touches it, and then the screen lights up the letter, and she if you're using low definition television, she's kept her figure and everything, but she's pretty ancient by now. At any rate, that's what people would. Her name's Vanna White. People would watch the show to see what Vanna White was wearing, but everybody knows. Everybody knows Wheel of Fortune. And so there was a meme. There's a picture of the board. And the only letters that you saw were J, then there was a missing letter, and then W and S. Right? And underneath the question was, who is ruining America? And the contestant, it showed as the contestant, Alex Jones, and he said, the globalists, which doesn't fit the letters, but he might have well have been saying the Chi-coms. And so, Donald Trump looks like he's poised to go back into the White House, and people are scratching their heads and trying to explain how this could happen. But so it's a distinct possibility Donald Trump could wind back in the White House. And of course, his first term, he was the victim of what I was calling the Jew d'etat. I mean, the Jews went after him. You look at the impeachment and who was running the impeachment committees, who was testifying against him, who in the press was tearing him down, or the Russiagate stuff. I mean, it was Jews just sniping at him from every direction. When he's out of the office, the Jews are trying to ruin him. You got these George Soros funded prosecutors who were taking him to court, getting his house raided, arresting him, getting mugshots of him. So with all of this, so if he comes back, will he come back with a vengeance? But the real question is, who will his vengeance be directed at? Will it be directed at the Jews, or will it be directed at the Chi-coms? Because there is a whole MAGA Inc., a astroturfed pro-Trump movement of people who don't really share the spirit of his campaign and are trying to hijack it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it became very, very anti-Chinese. So I'm throwing that out there, but the possibility of a Trump return. What of it, Mark? What of it?
Well, I think a Trump return will be very interesting. And I think it's obviously on the cards. I mean, you know, anyone that says it's not on the cards is obviously, you know, a complete and utter fool. You know, I should imagine that he will be basically back in the White House, and he will be in a situation where the first thing he's going to want to do, in my humble opinion, is essentially get rid of all of those charges against him, I should imagine the first thing he's going to want to do is get rid of the charges against him. And that would be, obviously for him, something that would be extremely preferable. So I should imagine the first thing will be the presidential pardon. And once he's given himself those pardons, it will then be about going in hard on probably settling scores with people he doesn't like. But I don't think he can really fight the election on those things. So I'm not sure whether we're actually going to see any of that for some time, because obviously, you know, no one could run a successful campaign on the idea that firstly, I'm going to exonerate myself. Secondly, I'm going to slay my enemies. Vote for me. You know, that would be extremely unrealistic.
And, I don't know if it's a winning platform, but I'll tell you, there would be a lot of support for it. His base would, it's not necessarily winning, but he could get a very enthusiastic 35% or 40% of the vote through such a platform. Thus, such is America these days.
He could, but I think it's going to need more than that. And that's the interesting thing. At the moment, Trump seems to be doing something that no other politician would. And he seems to be making noises that he would be using sort of civil rights legislation to actually bring in protections for white people. Now, firstly, before we obviously get into this, let's not sort of pretend he's a guy that delivers on all of his things. So let's not get too excited. You know, there's no point getting excited over this, because fundamentally, he's a guy that doesn't deliver a lot of the time. So I'm not saying he's going to come to power, do wonderful things, white people saved, bravo. I don't think that's going to happen. But there is a certain mileage that can be gained from simply talking about this, from simply bringing this up and having this as a discussion point, which is the interesting issue here. You know, Trump fundamentally talking about civil protections for white people is in itself a very important thing, because it's the kind of thing that the establishment would shudder at the thought of. And it's also the kind of thing that people like myself, people like you, people who are sort of ethno-nationalists, who are you know, white nationalists, it's the sort of thing they talk about. And essentially, from the establishment and media's point of view, talking about protections for white people under sort of civil rights or indigenous you know, rulings, it is a big thing. That's the kind of thing that we talk about, we suggest, we say this needs to be done, and it never is done. It's you know, it's never ever going to be put forward by anyone else, and us putting it forward is something that, when we do put it forward, we're called racists for putting it forward. So that's really interesting. And I think there is mileage in just discussing this. So I'm not saying that Trump's going to come in and pass this. I'm not saying that Trump's going to come in, sweep to power, pass this great legislation, white people saved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not naive enough to believe that, especially not after last time. But just getting this as a discussion point, just potentially having it in the mainstream that somebody wants protections for white people on sort of a racial or ethnic level, I think that's really important. I do actually think that's important. And I do think it's good, you know, for white people, you know, to discuss these things, or for these things to be discussed. And I will say, I don't think Trump is all bad. I've never believed Trump is all bad. I think Trump has done some terrible things. He's failed to deliver on a lot. And he's a bit of a bumbling oaf when it comes to what he does when he actually gets his hands on power. But I do think this is a positive. And I do think as well that the establishment would react in absolute horror at the idea of Donald Trump, you know, coming in and potentially using, you know, civil rights era legislation to actually enshrine rights for our people. So all of those. you know, coming in and potentially using, you know, civil rights era legislation to actually enshrine rights for our people. So all of those things, I think, fundamentally do point towards an interesting election period. And if Trump was to go sort of a step further and actively sort of name white people as, you know, as a voting group, because, you know, this is the issue, really, isn't it, Patrick? Every other group of people are named as an interest group during elections. So here in the UK, we constantly hear about the black vote. We had Operation Black Vote. We hear about the Muslim vote. There's no big surprise that Muslims vote as a bloc in their own interest. That is simply what the Muslim population do. And we always hear about the Jewish vote, you know, and often, you know, people who are expected to be the prime minister will spend time with powerful and influential members of the Jewish community, you know, just before the election, almost as if they're sort of paying tribute to those people. But nobody ever does that for whites, do they? You never have a situation where white people are fundamentally respected as a distinct ethnic group and put on some kind of pedestal. So white people are never put forward and said, look, you know, what are we going to do for the white voter? What are we going to do for the white man? And again, I've said this earlier, the suggestion, just the mere suggestion that somebody would turn around and say, what are we going to do for the white man, would cause a lot of liberals, you know, and people in the media, not just liberals, but people in the media, to recoil in absolute horror and, you know, shell shock, you know, to suggest that fundamentally, you know, white people should be spoken about in that way. It would cause people to, as I say, react in complete horror and shock and disbelief. So I think this is a good thing. And I think the more people we can get to discuss issues such as what is good for white people, the better. And if Trump is going to discuss these things quite openly, I think, again, that's an important sea change in, you know, US politics. Now, I know that a lot of people are going to say, look, Mark, Trump was a letdown last time. Are you supporting him? Well, he does not get my, you know, unequivocal seal of approval. But who could ever get your unequivocal seal of approval as if they could do no wrong? Probably nobody. But I will say this. If he can be useful shifting the discourse in such a way that we eventually end up in a situation where white people are treated as a group that deserves to advocate for their ethnic interests, that can only be a good thing. That can only be moving the dial in our direction. And I would be thankful for that, because, you know, for my entire life, we've never seen anything like that. And we certainly haven't seen anything like that in the UK. And if you do see it, as I said, it's always done from the point of view of a fringe candidate. What are your thoughts on this, Patrick?
So Trump has, even to an extent while he was president, but certainly somewhat more so since he left office, talked about white people to an extent. He'll talk about white people being under attack or discrimination against white people. He'll mention it. And, you know, Trump tends to talk in bumper sticker length. Are they even sound bites? So just he doesn't have very well-formed sentences. You know, Mark, you might know that before I did this show on RBN, I used to have a YouTube channel where I'd interview somebody, and you were somebody who had come on. This is like 2016 and 2017. And I was only doing it about once a week. And one thing I used to do was, because I was only doing it once a week and I wanted it to sound really good, is I would go through the sound file and I would remove all the ums and uhs, and I would clean up the language and make it sound like everybody's really, really smart. And I'm telling you this because it's true, not just because I'm trying to get on your good side. I had to do virtually no cleanup of your language. Because now, one thing is you speak a little bit slowly, but you speak extremely clearly and in well-formed sentences. And there's other people who I always think of as being extremely articulate, like Mark Dankoff, for instance. But even him, I'd have to clean up ums and uhs and stuff like that. And with myself, oh, big time. I like That's why I was doing it. I was really doing it to make myself sound smarter. But while I was at it, I'd clean up the other person's language. Donald Trump, he speaks in such with such poor syntax and run-on sentences and just sentence fragments. And it makes him very, very unclear. And there might be something strategic to that. Maybe that suits him. But yeah, so he doesn't speak particularly clearly about anything. But he has been talking about white interests to an extent. And then Tucker Carlson, who, maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago, had said something like, if people start talking about white interests, if they say they're representing white people, they should go to hell. Or he said something even worse than that, which was really pretty offensive. But Tucker Carlson's starting to interview people who are talking about whites. And then, of course, we didn't really get a chance to talk about it much, but Candace Owens, who famously just a week or so ago got fired from her lucrative job at the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire. Because
hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
And then, of course, we didn't really get a chance to talk about it much, but Candace Owens, who famously just a week or so ago got fired from her lucrative job at the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire, because she's getting in fights with rabbis and talking about Israel and to an extent a Jewish mafia that has a lot of power in America. But, you know, Candace Owens, for years, this has been her thing. She kind of represents white interests. She was allowed because she was black. You can't have a white person representing white interests. She was almost like the official spokesman for white interests. And her being fired by the Daily Wire, it may silence her for a while, but it may raise her prominence. And so, yeah, we've got an election campaign, and election campaigns, aside from selecting people who are going to serve in offices, and everybody thinks, oh, well, these people are such jokers. What difference does the election make? Because everybody sucks. But the election campaigns are vehicles for agenda setting, both in the government and in popular society. And the prospect of getting the discussion of white rights and anti-white discrimination to get it out there, the campaign could be extremely important, regardless of who wins and who loses. The campaigns, they set agendas. So maybe that was a little long-winded, but I'm kicking it back. Those are my thoughts on it, Mark. I kick it back to you.
I agree. And I do think this is going to start seeping into the mainstream. I do think there is going to be some form of mainstream renaissance around white people as an electoral interest. And there has to be. There has to be. And I know that sounds sort of very forceful. Like that, there has to be. There just has to be. But there does have to be. You know, this cannot continue forever. The situation that we are living in cannot continue forever. We can't just keep going down this route or this road of white people being whipped, literally sort of whipped time and, well, not literally, but sort of metaphorically whipped time and time and time again, and just taking more and more and more and more of this abuse. Because eventually there is going to be, or a time will come, where there is a pushback to this. There has to be. That's just how things always work. There is always a time where people will say, enough is enough. We have had enough of this. We don't want any more of this. That is it. Game over. Enough. We're pushing back. And I think now more than ever, it's almost as if people need permission to say, enough is enough. People need permission to say, we don't want this anymore. We want to be able to stand up for themselves. And Donald Trump is an influential man, because when he starts talking about these things, I feel for many, that's a time where they fundamentally feel like they have permission to do it as well. They look to Donald Trump as a leader, as somebody that they agree with, somebody that, despite not being a common man, they believe he speaks for the common man. And I think that fundamentally they look to him as the guy to say, this is where the mark now is. This is what you can speak about. So immigration had never really seemed as big. Immigration, talk of immigration always seemed a lot more on the table in the UK than it had in America. So in America, I've never really seen immigration be as hotly contested as it was when Donald Trump brought that up. Now, that doesn't mean normal Americans weren't talking about it behind closed doors, or normal Americans weren't concerned about it, or that it wasn't in the hearts of normal Americans. But it seemed as if they needed some kind of approval in order, or sort of a nod, if you like, you know, a nod as if to say, yeah, you can talk about this now. You can speak about this. It's OK. Say what you really think. And it's almost like people needed that. And then all of a sudden, people started talking about it. All of a sudden, people wanted to talk about immigration, about building a wall, about, changing the way the system worked in America. And that's very important. That's very interesting. And it's very interesting because fundamentally, we haven't seen it before. But it was Donald Trump who gave those people the nod, if you like, gave those people the kind of go ahead, said to those people, hey, you know, it's OK. You can talk about this. You can speak about this. It's time. You're allowed. I'm giving you the green light. And if Donald Trump starts talking about white people as an ethnic group standing up for their own interests, well, boy, that's going to be a big thing, isn't it? That's going to be the kind of thing where everybody is like, OK, is this it now? Is this sort of open season upon, discussions to do with race and to do with white interests? And if it is, that's a game changer, because for the first time, in recent memory, white people will be talking about their group interest as they never have done before. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that's the kind of thing that would lead to potentially a sea change in American politics, which is obviously what we need. We need people to be talking about things that they have never previously talked about before, or they've talked about, but only talked about behind closed doors. So I'm very much looking at this and thinking to myself, well, this has got to be a good thing. This has got to be a really, really good thing for white Americans. And as I said, I'm not naive enough to think that Donald Trump is going to be the guy that would enact this or make good on any of this, but he is the kind of guy that will put it on the table. And as we often say, once the genie's out of the bottle, it's impossible to get it back in there. Once people are talking about our racial interests, once there is the go-ahead or the green light for white people to advocate in terms of, you know, white in-group preference, you know, what's good for our people, it becomes very difficult to take that away. And you've seen this with other ethnic groups. Once other ethnic groups have been incentivized to talk about their interests, you can't take that away from them. Because once you've got your hands on those things, well, you can, but it either takes something very, very cataclysmic, or it has to be done over a very long period of time with a degree of genuine brainwashing, which I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, whites talking about their own rights, that was now what, post-Second World War talk in the South, or maybe pre-Second World War talk in the South. But it's taken decades to beat that out of white Southern Americans. It would take decades to beat that out of black people, out of Jews. We'd never beat it out of Jews, out of Muslims, etc. But it would also take media compliance. And obviously that's never going to change. These people are never going to let go of what is good for them. But I think what we're seeing now is potentially an awakening amongst whites. And once white people have awoken in that sense, especially for them to awaken in that sense in such a hostile environment, how would you shut them up again? How would you shut them up? You know, once they start talking about their civil rights, how are you shutting up white people? You know, I don't see how you could. And I think this is a real, real positive for our people.
Yeah. And the point that people have not, that they need the nod to talk about something. You made that point. And that's a very important point. And on a show that I've already recorded, and it will be broadcast on Thursday with a show with Philbert, we were talking about how a lot of issues, people who are really high IQ get it. And people who are really low IQ and poorly educated get it, but the vast swath of people in between, they're educated and intelligent enough to understand the indoctrination, the propaganda, and they eat it up and they buy it. There have been a lot of memes on Andrew Anglin's Monday memes that make a similar point to this. So you often have that. And so the point about white people talking about their interests behind closed doors, well, the people who are doing it behind closed doors are the smart people who understand what's going on, and the stupid people who don't have the filter or don't have who are too uncouth to abide by the norms that have been imposed on us. And everybody in the middle, well, we're not allowed to talk about it, and they won't talk about it. And so that permission that Trump or some other prominent public figure can bestow on people through his example, that big, that middle 80 or 90% of the people, they're not talking about these things behind closed doors. They weren't talking about immigration behind closed doors. And if you talk about these people now, these are the people who are worried about the Chinese, right? If you go to the elite, they might not talk about Jewish power, but they ought to be at least aware of it. If you're talking about something like Jewish power, through self-deception, through whatever, through a bunch of means, they're not. If you go to the hood in Harlem, they're a lot more likely to probably have some sort of awareness of Jewish power just because that's the landlord. And Trump, or potentially somebody with a high profile like Elon Musk or Tucker Carlson or somebody else, if they would make this into an issue, then it would permeate through the culture. Candace Owens, by the way, she first got her. She was a designated white person defender, but the power structure, and I'll call it the Jewish power structure, was kind of okay with it, because she was kosher enough. But when she went out with Kanye West at the Paris fashion show back in the autumn of 2022, wearing the White Lives Matter T-shirts, that started a lot of trouble, and now it's kind of culminated in her getting in these open fights with rabbis and saying that Jews are a very a very powerful Jewish mafia here. So yeah, it would be. I think it's likely that white rights and anti-white discrimination is going to start being discussed openly, and that Trump will be a part of that. If ever the next step of having a real discussion about Jewish power ever takes place, that would be interesting, but that probably can't take place. It's probably not very likely to take place until the discussion of white interest takes place, because, whites supposedly run society. And if society is being run against white interest, it does pose the question, well, then how does that happen? If whites run society, but specifically against their own interests, how does that happen? Well, it doesn't happen because whites don't run society. So, that question gets begged. We'll see what happens. What do you think about that, Mark?
Well, I think Candace Owens is somebody that's very, very interesting. And it is interesting to note, you used a good term, sort of the designated defender. She was a designated defender of white people. And obviously she was allowed to defend white people because she has what we could call black privilege. She's in a situation where if she talks about white people as a racial group and suggests white people as a racial group should be allowed to defend their own interests, she's not going to get the same pushback as a white person saying it, because she has a certain degree of privilege and power because she is black, and she's a black female, who worked for the Daily Wire, and she was saying these things and she was getting away with it. But it got to a point where she was making so much noise, people were like, you need to turn this down. Her bosses, Ben Shapiro, etc., he's the de facto sort of king of the Daily Wire. And if he says enough's enough, we don't want any more of this, that's when it has to stop. And I think Candace Owens didn't want to stop. And there's also something today where you don't really have to be threatened. If you're a popular content creator and you're producing good quality, top tier, you know, content on your for someone else, well, you can produce good quality, top tier content for yourself. You know, you don't have to keep producing it for someone else. And Candice Owens may well have looked at this and said to herself, you know, do I need to keep making this content for Ben Shapiro, or could I make content, put it on X, and get money from going alone? I mean, Stephen Crowder, he's made a lot of money doing it himself. And so have other people that have broken away. I mean, look at Tucker Carlson. You know, Tucker Carlson landed arguably the most important political interview of his entire career and became talk of the whole world when he left Fox News. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll never, you know, at Fox News, I don't believe he ever interviewed somebody. I don't think he ever got landed an interview that was as talked about as much as his Putin interview. And that goes to show that the situation we are living in today is so fundamentally different than it was a few years ago. And that means that people like Candice Owens are less likely to, you know, to toe a particular line. And that must be scary for these media bosses, because for a long time, people who worked in the mainstream media would always have to toe that particular, you know, political line that their bosses wanted them to toe. And if they didn't, that's it. You're out of a job. And where do you go? You know, if you were, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if you were let go by Fox News and no one else wanted to employ you, what did you do? Well, you might have scratched around and found some sort of maverick local station that would employ you. You might have started your own sort of little, you know, radio show that went out locally, or maybe, you know, you taped it and you sold the tapes nationally. I know that people used to do that. You know, look at William Luther Pierce. He would do that. His American dissident voices, he would tape those, and those tapes would be sent out to people who wanted them. You know, that could be done, but Look at William Luther Pierce. He would do that. His American dissident voices, he would tape those, and those tapes would be sent out to people who wanted them. You know, that could be done. But until the advent of the internet, it was much harder going down that road. Now it's much easier. And look, people know that I'm a big fan of computer games. The same thing has happened in the world of computer games journalism. People no longer dream about writing for a computer game magazine. You know, when we were kids, we always, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we wrote for a computer game magazine? You'd get paid to write reviews for game. You play games all day, then write reviews about them. This would be the best thing ever. You know, that was something, you know, young lads would talk about. Now, nobody wants to be employed. Well, there's no computer game magazines anymore because there's very little physical media. But, you know, people don't dream anymore about writing for a website or being part of a media group. They dream about starting their own YouTube channel, starting their own media empire, being, you know, and some of the most respected people in the world of games journalism, the influencers, etc. They've never, ever worked for a traditional publishing house. They have never, ever worked for a big website. They've never been part of any centralized form of media. They've just done it on their own, off their own back, with, you know, a YouTube account and a Twitter account and an Instagram account. And this tells you that people like, you know, like the Daily Wire at one point, you know, if you got a gig there, you wouldn't want to be separated from that. It might actually be financially better for Candace Owens to go out like this, go on her own. And if she plays her cards right, like Tucker did, you could actually end up with a much bigger audience and the freedom to interview who you want, speak to who you want. And again, somebody like her in today's, you know, political, what could you call it, political situation, for want of a better term, she might end up sat at the table with Tucker Carlson, with Elon Musk, with a group of people that are actually more influential than Ben Shapiro. Now, I'm not saying Ben Shapiro doesn't have influence, because he does, but she could actually, if she plays her cards right, upgrade here. And I'm sure, I am absolutely sure, I'd bet, you know, bet my house on it, that she has already been in talks with some people, that she's already in a situation where she will have been approached by you know, different platforms, maybe even spoken to Elon Musk or had a private correspondence about going and doing her thing on X. I don't know, but I'm sure something will have happened. Someone will have reached out to her and presented options. And these options could end up being far more lucrative than anything she's ever had. And that's a wonderful thing.
And here's one last point, because we're just about out of time. You know, she's 34. She'll be 35 later this year. My understanding is she's married to an Englishman, and a very wealthy Englishman, and she may well be in a position where she doesn't actually have to think about what's lucrative for the time being, at least. She could think exclusively about reach and not and do something, even if it's not very well monetized, because she doesn't have to, you know, she doesn't have to meet huge mortgage payments on a mansion, because she might not have even been the main breadwinner in her family. So I don't know if that's the case. I'm just throwing it out there, but we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you for joining me, Mark.
Well, thank you so much. And please can everyone go and follow me on my social media, Telegram, Gab, BitChute, Rumble, and Odyssey.
Yes, everybody do that. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Beagle Radio.